Welcome to the Creative Condition Podcast, an ongoing series of conversations and considerations to help people understand and embrace their own unique creativity for fulfilling lives and brilliant careers. My name is Ben Tallon. I'm an illustrator and author, and I bring 16 years of creative industry experience working with the New York Times, The Guardian, the Premier League, and more. And I invite designers, artists, psychologists, scientists, coaches, athletes, sensitivity experts, and all kinds of thought leaders to help us broaden our knowledge of creativity. Creativity is a fundamental pillar of human happiness, a vital ingredient in the solutions to our problems, but so often misunderstood. The show is supported by founding sponsor and B Corp, Illustration X. Take a look at their stunning range of illustrators and animators at illustrationx.com. If you like the music for the show, it's by Dirty Freud, who you can listen to now on Spotify and all good music streaming services.
I think it's absolutely essential to do personal work. Mm-hmm. Like, I literally don't know a single designer that I respect that doesn't do personal work.
Today I'm joined by legendary graphic designer Stefan Sagmeister, who returns to the show for the second time, and I bring you our conversation live at Off Festival 2024 in its entirety. This is The Creative Condition. Hello and welcome to the show. How are you doing? My name is Ben Tallon. This is The Creative Condition. How are you doing, guys? Are you well? I'm going to bring you today, as I mentioned just there, the whole of our conversation at Off Festival 2024, which is just as deep as our first, if not deeper. So if you didn't hear that one, I do strongly suggest you go back to episode 199 to hear my first conversation with Stefan Sagmeister. Stefan was on fantastic form as his book Now Is Better was about to be released. And I was able to lure him to Barcelona at Off Festival 2024, where we went on the main stage Friday evening. Fantastic spot, wonderful audience, really warm, supportive audience who gave such great feedback actually after the show, because I was more nervous than I ever am for these talks. And that should come as no surprise. You know, we're talking about a jump of from what was a previous best of maybe 3-4 tops 500 audience at Off Festival 23 to maybe 2,500 at Off Festival 2024. You know, big stage. I have to admit, I worried about how this chat would convert, and would it feel intimate? Would it still feel, as somebody once described my interview style, as overhearing an interesting conversation in a pub? You know, that's the day. They were the fears. And I remember just as we were about to go on stage, saying to Stefan, are you going left or right? Because I do not want to be crashing into you on stage. You know, I'm 6'2", so I'm quite tall. But Stefan's probably about 6'6", and I didn't want that kind of collision, Basil Fawlty-esque, going on stage, you know, ahead of this big moment. So he laughed and he's like, I'll go right. I'll go nearest because the chair's slightly taller. We had a mismatching chairs for the conversation, and yeah, it was good. We'll get more into that in a minute. But first, I've just got to thank the founding sponsor of the show, Illustration X. You can find their global range of illustrators and animators now over at illustrationx.com, where they'll help you to find the right animator, lettering specialist, fashion illustrator, muralist, you name it. They've got it all going on over there, and they're a B Corp doing a lot of great work for our industry. So go and have a look at them now, illustrationx.com. Also, a big shout out to the Ukrainian Institute. I do touch upon the Ukrainian war and strife in our conversation, and any regular listeners of the show will be well aware about the connection with Olya Protasova, a design activist, illustrator, and designer from Kiev, who came on the show, going back a little bit, to talk about their plight and to talk about why creativity and artistry still matters. So do have a listen to that episode if you get the chance. But also check out the Ukrainian Institute, who are doing awesome work to connect the Ukrainian creative community with the rest of the world, because they need all the help they can get. I don't think I need to tell you guys that. Anyway, so Stefan, yeah, this was a big thing for me. This was a big, big moment. And Stefan was suffering with the flu on the day. And we got to do some local press with Dis and Ehub, where, you know, the festival, where our festival is held. So we spent about two and a half hours together drinking coffee and having a look at the set and making some decisions about the backdrop, which was quite, you know, late in the day. We switched from some prepared slides that I'd done with hand lettering. Didn't feel so good on the day when I saw it in person. So Stefan and I had a chat, and to Stefan's credit, he could have just commandeered, you know, the whole thing and made the decision, and I wouldn't really have challenged it, him being Stefan Sagmeister and all. But he didn't. He said, look, you know, this is your thing. You're hosting me. What do you think? And in the end, we agreed that given we were discussing predominantly Now Is Better, Stefan's current impressive body of work, that really should be the visual. So Stefan brought up some slides, showed me them, and I said, you know what? Yeah, we've got a big room there where they're going to be talking for 50 minutes. If it's just two guys having a conversation, that works. I've seen that done in the past. But it's going to be so much better if we can run the images that we're going to be building our conversation around. So that's what we did. Very much a collaborative decision. And Stefan was just, you know, he's a pro in this environment. But he was a lovely, lovely man in the day. We had conversations about all kinds of things around creativity, about his work, about my work. He was every bit as curious about me and as I was him. So it went well, and he put me at ease. And what more can you ask from a personal hero? You know, I mentioned before that Stefan's work was on my wall in 2004, 5, 6, while I was studying at UCLan in Preston on an illustration degree. You know, this was work with balls and with attitude and with serious swagger and a real pioneer. It stood out from the crowd in the books we'd find on the coffee tables in the studio. So, you know, I did have to suppress my inner fanboy. I'm not too proud to say that. And it was funny as we roamed around Disney Hub drinking coffee and you know, just talking and looking at things. Stefan would be stopped kind of every 20 paces or so for a picture or, you know, for a little natter. And it's quite comical. I very humbly stood aside and let that happen. And I asked him how he felt about that. And he said he really enjoyed it because people tended to be very lovely in this industry. And it was a nice ego boost. But at the same time, it didn't happen outside of design, so it didn't bother him in the way that, you know, fame in a mainstream sense does change your life and makes for a weird existence where you kind of have to hide away. And as he told me a story about wanting to photograph Mick Jagger in the streets in New York when they were working with the Rolling Stones, and how they were told no, because that would cost $300,000 to shut the street down, you know? And therefore, that just creates a very strange life where you can't walk down the street anonymously anymore. And we agreed that would be a waking nightmare for us, you know. But ultimately, the thing went well. The audience was great. The festival was magic, as I've said many times before. So there's only so much more I can say. We covered some of the opening segments back on episode 199, but I wanted to respect the live audience and get back to the roots of his project again. So I've left that in this conversation. Feel free to skip past that bit if you've already heard the previous episode and you find that boring to get, you know, a few minutes in. And then we take on a whole different trajectory around the same topic and around the same themes of optimism and long-term thinking. And I mentioned a couple of episodes ago, you know, I got some correspondence from several people afterwards who were discussing the optimism sentiment. And what I wanted to reiterate that I think that we covered in this conversation was that Stefan has no way his head in the sand. You know, this is, he acknowledges the major problems that we do face and what is wrong in the world, and that we are living in some respects very tough times. At the same time, his whole point is, do we buckle under that and just give up and hide away, or do we fight that? Do we step up as the generation who has to fight that and find a way to be optimistic by looking at our previous successes. And that's the point of his book. And if you read it cover to cover, he does talk about the deeper stuff, the problems that we're not tackling right now, the climate crisis, for example. But he does also acknowledge small steps even in that regard, you know, in terms of increasing marine reserve areas, protected marine reserves. And, you know, I think we have no choice but to find optimism, because the alternative is just altogether bleak and it's defeatist. And that's what I believe the people who are perpetrating the evils in the world, that's what they want from us. They want a broken, defeated society. When was that any different, you know? So I think his point is not, let's just see everything with rose-tinted glasses, as he discussed in you know, in episode 199, but let's find the optimism. Let's find the fun in the challenge. And let's go for it. Let's grab it by the balls and let's contribute with our skills and our knowledge and our energy. So I hope you find this one uplifting. That was the point. It kind of does follow on from 199, so go back and listen to that if you haven't. Once again, big thank you to Hector Ayuso for making this possible, and Off Festival. What a wonderful team of staff. And some of you might have seen recently that Hector has announced that after 24 years, he is stepping back from his duties at Off, that now is the time for a new challenge. And he's handing the reins over to his business partner, Pep, who I'm sure will do an absolutely stunning job, you know, having been the other half of Off in terms of steering it from the very top. And good luck to them all, because, you know, I would love to continue being a part of it. It's a magic festival, it's a magic environment, and if you haven't been already, I highly recommend getting yourself out there. So big thank you to everybody who made this one possible. Thank you to those of you coming on the night. You might enjoy listening to this one back. And for everybody else, I hope you get a real lift from this. Cheers, guys.
Well, hello, everybody.
Evening.
Ben.
Stefan. So I hope you're all feeling good and you've had a good festival. This is awesome. Well, Stefan needs no introduction to you guys. But I feel like his recent body of work does. It had a quite a profound effect on me recently, and I felt quite strongly that I wanted to do what little I could within my power to spread the word, because it's I feel like it's important for our time. But Stefan is the man to tell you about that. So let's start with now. Where do we find you right now in your life, and tell us about the origin of Now Is Better.
Balda. Past 5 years, I decided not to do any more commercial work, not because I suddenly hate commercial work, not at all, but because I felt I've done my share, I've done enough for my lifetime, in the same way that after 7 years of album covers, I felt I've done enough of those. Mm-hmm. And the opportunity presented itself that I was a resident designer at the American Academy in Rome, which is a great, fantastic situation. You work all day in a beautiful studio overlooking Rome, and then there are these great dinners that are very salon-like, with 69 other residents there, filmmakers, writers, philosophers, theater makers, all smart people. And at one of those dinners, a very intelligent lawyer told me that what we're looking at right now is the end of liberal, or the end of modern democracy. And when I looked that up that night, back in the studio, basically, I Googled it. It became clear that if you looked at it from the long-term perspective, 200 years ago, there was a single democratic country in the world. 100 years, there were 16. Now there are 86. For the first time in human history, more than half of us, of humanity, lives in a democratic system. So this smart, highly educated lawyer had no clue of the world that he lives in. And that I found interesting. And when I did some proper research ahead of time, it turned out that everything, almost everything that you look at from the long term basically has a 180-degree different point of view than when you look at it from the short term. And all media, both social media as traditional media, by its definition, has to look at things from the short term because it comes in a very, very tiny, short cycle. And you can check that quickly. A monthly magazine will be more positive than a daily newspaper. And with Twitter or X or always available newscasting, this has become extreme. And so much negative news are coming to us, not because the media is evil. It's because we all want it, including me. I find negative news much more interesting than positive news. I have a former client and friend now, David Byrne, the singer of the Talking Heads, who has, similar to me, a beautiful little news organization called Reasons to be Cheerful. And of course I follow it, but I don't always read it. If he would have a news organization called Reasons to be Angry, it would be much more interesting. And this is not just me saying it. There is many really good studies. There's one coming out of, well, there's just a measurement study of which kind of, that shows you that it's not the media, it's us, which kind of article is mostly forwarded by emails from the New York Times. Number one is anger and outrage, by far. This is what we want our friends to know, anger and outrage. And all this is okay because we need all that negativity also to give us a kick in the ass to change the many things that need changing. But if you look at the world from the long perspective and see that it's the completely opposite, most things that are important to us developed beautifully, but they don't work in the short term because they developed slowly to be very, very good. Mm-hmm. You know, and maybe that's too long of an answer. I'll finish it by the headline, 135,000 people escaped extreme poverty, could have been run on the front page of our newspapers every single day for the past 20 years. And it didn't run for a single day because it just develops too slowly. And we're not all that interested in it. So ultimately, I found that an interesting and juicy piece of information to be involved in as a communication designer and dedicated basically the past 5 years of the studio to it.
Mm-hmm. Which is incredible. And you talk a lot about conditional optimism. And that was something I personally relinquished temporarily. It was I was a new parent. I was exhausted. So my defenses were a little lower than they might previously have been. And I find myself exactly in that scenario that you just described. One heavy headline on social media would send me into a personal mini spiral. And I think that everyone in this room can probably relate to that feeling because we spend a lot of time on screens and we're quite exposed to that. But when I read your project, your book, and read about the conditional optimism and looked at the statistics that you presented so beautifully, it changed my life. It brought me back to a baseline that was optimistic, and I felt like my projects were valid once more and my creativity had value. Was that a conscious effort that you made with this project? Was that a part of your motivation to give that feeling to more people?
Well, see, I myself also don't think that everything is rosy.
Of course.
You know, I'm very aware that we have a war going on in the Ukraine, the unbelievable disasters between Israel and Gaza. And at the same time, I have friends who really live in the space of doom and gloom. And doom and gloom is not empowering. If I look at myself, if I'm depressed, I'm totally, utterly useless to my surroundings. I don't do anything. I'm like, my friends and family are fucked because I'm not doing nothing. And I absolutely believe that big social change is possible when you have information that's both the carrot and the whip. And it's not just an opinion of mine. I looked into this. If you look at big social changes from the past, let's say 20 years, one thing that stands out is the unbelievable success of the no-smoking campaigns. You know, many countries cut the amount of smokers in half. A phenomenon. People who are totally addicted, half of them would stop smoking. And when you look at how this was achieved, it was the whip and the carrot. There were all these negative things about, you know, you're going to get cancer on the package. But there was also the promise of positivity. It needed both for this to be successful. And right now it seems that the media, both social and traditional, is delivering plenty of the whip. And I try to add, you know, some bites of carrots here and there.
Yeah. And there's a huge evolutionary aspect to this. And that's something that you hit upon wonderfully. And as a species, we're the only species that can pivot quickly in terms of mass change. And that is reliant upon the myth that we collectively believe, and I'm speaking in terms of the advent of religions, agriculture. When these major changes happened, or we needed to pivot because of, you know, extreme weather conditions, whatever it might be throughout human history, we can outrun our evolutionary, you know, genetic change. We're the only species that can do that. And that can happen when the myth changes. And I believe that the more projects like this and the more sea change happens with growing awareness of the way that our brains work and the reason that so many people say, what's the fucking point? You know, that's happening. The more we can become consciously aware of that and learn to control that, I think that change is entirely possible again on all fronts. You know, look at the advances of science and technology in the last 20 years. It's incredible. And you speak of data as being a bulwark against the primitive biases, that evolutionary side of things. Data often gets demonized now because of, you know, the many downsides of that, but this is a huge upside of that. So let's talk about that research side of this and your exploration of all these numbers and the kind of collaboration that would have entailed.
I mean, you know, I'm of course also aware that data can be cold. Obviously, it can be manipulated. Obviously, it can be, you know, put into one direction. I try to get my data from very good sources. I have two big heroes in my life, one being Steven Pinker at Harvard, the other one Max Roser at Oxford. Both of those made many pieces of work that are extremely helpful to what I do. Max Roser has a gigantic site called Our World in Data, where they publish almost on a daily matter. It's a fairly sizable team now, data that they have access to, but it's always of checked sources. But at the same time, you know, I also do things like look into my own family, because I know that it's just more interesting and more human to have a single story than just looking at data. You know, and if I looked at the history of my family, as in my great-grandparents, my great-great-grandparents, you know, meaning it's amazing. My great-great-grandparents had the worst thing that happened that can happen to a parent. You are a parent. Meaning the absolute worst thing that could possibly happen to you would be the death of a child. Happened to my great-great-grandparents 6 times. Mm. And not because they were completely fucked. It was just these were the times. Not quite 58% of all children reached adulthood. Mm. And if you look at the sequence, these kids died. Two died at one died at four, one died at six, two died at eight. Meaning these were members of your family. These were not just, you know, this was amazing hardship. And we're talking 120 years ago.
Yeah.
My great-grandparents, the next generation of Sargmeisters, it happened to them five times. You know, and it happened to them even though they were the elite of their neighborhood. And the reason that they were the elite of their neighborhood was because they belonged to the 15% who were literate. You know, I mean, you're talking 100, 110 years ago, where only 15% of all Austrians could read or write.
Yeah.
And that actually is connected with not these, but many of the images that you see here, because the first 200-year-old paintings actually came from my great-great-grandparents who had a small antique store in the house that I ultimately grew up in, and those were the leftovers stored in the attic of our house. That's how the whole series started. And for those of you who don't know, like those, not these, but those antique-looking images that you see are mostly 200-year-old paintings that we cut up and put new inserts inside that kind of look abstract, but are ultimately data visualizations, showing one particular thing on how it developed over the past 200 years.
Mm. And, you know, speaking of human stories, we had a conversation six months ago when your book first came out on my podcast. And, you know, my audience is very moderate. Sometimes I feel like I'm just doing this thing alone in my studio, you know? But I was contacted by Olya Protasova, who is a Ukrainian illustrator and designer. And you mentioned the Ukrainian war, you know, as one of the many things, the issues that we have as a collective species. And Olya got in touch to say that having heard this episode, our conversation, she had managed to get together with a team of other creatives in Ukraine to crowdsource and put together a deal to get your book translated into Ukrainian. And this blew my mind, because the way that she put this, she said, look, despite the fact that here in Kiev, bombs could fall at any time, we still must make beautiful art and create and be defiant. And this blew me away, you know, to think that this tiny link in the chain came around through that conversation. Question I want to ask about that, do you know when you're creating this work that I think is incredibly meaningful, do you think about the onward trajectory and the potential power, or are you happy with the magic to release that and know that because you felt so strongly about it, that is all possible?
Well, I have to admit that before I heard that, I actually said in talks, I probably wouldn't do this talk right now in the Ukraine, because I can't imagine that people who have bombs falling on their head give a shit about the fact that there are now fewer people killed in wars than 100 years ago. This is not what you need to hear. Mm-hmm. And I was super surprised when I was invited to do a similar talk in Lviv, in the Ukraine, and we are now even talking about having the exhibition go there. So, I mean, for me, obviously, this is extremely wonderful that even people who go through hardship would be open to listen to a message like that and even invite it. Yeah.
Well, for that very reason, I felt apprehensive, because we agreed to have a conversation off the back of that, because I felt there was great power in her message. And I almost couldn't ask the question, but I made myself ask the question. I said, how can now be better when that's going on in your life? And she said, I'll tell you why now is better, because exactly like you said, Stefan, she said, my grandparents, they had to live through Holodomor, which was a genocide. So yes, now is better, because we can communicate with the outside world. We have global support, and that's bravery. That's real bravery. That's, you know, that's inspiring and noble and everything that's good. But that doesn't happen if they don't have the, you know, that sense of magic and that desire to create, because we need to have something more than survival as human beings. And it's bigger than us. And this is something that came up in your Happy film, was, you know, one of the core pillars of happiness was to work towards something that is bigger than ourselves. So talking of the work since your commercial projects, how does it feel for you as an individual to be immersed in these long-term projects?
Well, I think one of the, you know, when we did the Happy film and the Happy show, I was immersed in that space, basically positive psychology, for about 8 years. And one of the many things that I've learned was that all of us are ultimately much more interested in meaning in our jobs than we are in compensation. If you give people a choice, they will always go for meaning before they go for compensation. I think that's universal. I'm sure that everybody in this audience would somehow wanna have that feeling that what you just did today, what you completed, was meaningful. And I, of course, I'm in a particularly luxurious situation where I can say, okay, like, I'm concentrating full power. I'm not just doing this as a here and there project on my free time in the evenings. I'm doing this all the time. And ultimately, I think it was also very much influenced by the sabbatical years. You know, I'm about at the end of this year to go on another sabbatical, even though that's a little strange because in many ways I am already on sabbatical, so I'm taking a sabbatical from a sabbatical. But at the same time, I did three, you know, one in 2000, one in 2008, one in 2015. I did three sabbaticals, and they all were unbelievably important for the studio, to the point where when I look back on the studio years, I automatically separated by phase one, phase two, phase three, and phase four by the sabbaticals. And in fact, we're going to have sort of a retrospective exhibition in New York in fall, and this is how it's ordered. You know, one, two, three, four, divided by the sabbaticals, because the sabbaticals changed the studios so incredibly. And I don't think I've ever would have had the wherewithal to say, okay, I'm doing this all the time, if I wouldn't have had the training of leading up to it. So, and I don't think that it's that important that you do a full year, but I do think, and I'm sure that many other speakers that you've heard in the last 2 days probably would either agreed on stage or would agree, I think it's absolutely essential to do personal work. Mm-hmm. Like, I literally don't know a single designer that I respect that doesn't do personal work.
Yeah.
Like, I think that's, yeah, it's, if your desire is to do good work, that is necessary. Mm-hmm. Out of many reasons, but some of them are purely practical, because many of us are fearful. And often it's just too scary to try out something totally new when the deadline is looming and the client wanted something slightly different. So trying that out for yourself first is unbelievably helpful to then maybe show it to a client and they would say, oh, that's actually what I want. Happens, I mean, I've seen that happening in our own studio lots of times, and I've seen many, many other designers where that happened all the time.
Well, you, in terms of sabbaticals, you have to get out of the way of your own shit to see forwards. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the way we're wired. The unconscious mind has as much influence over knowing the way forward as the conscious mind. But we're so bombarded by information these days, and we spend so much time being so busy, that if you don't make time to step aside and allow the unconscious to do its job, then those great seemingly random ideas, they don't come. And in terms of personal work, absolutely, personal lines of inquiry, that relates to emotional creativity. And this is only, I only heard it termed like this recently, but intellectual creativity and emotional creativity, emotional being the things we want to say because it's in us and it's the way we see the world. Intellectual creativity being maybe client projects. It's not that they can't also entail emotional creativity, but as we all know, in our commercial work, oftentimes we're working on someone else's ideas and the like. So I think you're absolutely right. It's completely critical. And you know, your work has always had a real organic element to it, especially this project. You're working with, like you said, 200-year-old paintings. That, in terms of that process and the time you spend in that organic environment, how much time of that do you spend alone, and how much time of that is with as part of a team?
Well, by now, it's quite a bit alone because the team is so good. Mm-hmm. So it's different in the past 5 years. I work sometimes with freelancers, often alone. And then we have a team in the Brooklyn Navy Yard, and we have an office there, but that's more like a woodworking shop rather than a traditional design office. You know, it's dirty, there is machinery and things, so we can really create things there. And in the beginning, of course, I was out there quite a lot because we had to figure out how this all works. By now, they're so good at it. I also think that the work got better, just at least technically, because we just know, you know, what kind of resin has what kind of thickness, yeah, fits into how kind of canvas, how to get rid of duplication canvases, how to fold them in so that it doesn't bulk up. Like a lot of stuff that we have a full-time restorator as part of the team, because once you mangle those old canvases, stuff splits off that needs to be restored, and you know. But so now it's the process, I would say, is actually very different from, I don't know, us designing album covers.
Yeah.
It's actually much closer to the band than it is to the cover. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when we did design album covers, I listened, or I sometimes would go to the studio and I would watch the band record, or sometimes even how they wrote the song. And you could tell that it could start with a beat from the drummer, it could start with a bass line, it could start with a guitar riff, the whole thing could start with some fraction of a lyric or even a song title. It could come from all directions, and it would be built upon that. And this is much closer to that, as in, it could start with the data. It could start with a composition idea. It could start with a colorway. It could start with the painting, with the historic painting. It could start with a composition. Mm-hmm. So, and then it's building slowly. Sometimes it needs 10 different approaches until this thing works.
And is your compass feeling for that?
It's gut feeling, yeah. It's basically, it's easy, actually. It's basically, I do it so long, I probably right now have 25 paintings going on. Today in the morning, even though I feel sicklish, you can probably hear it in my voice a little bit, I have sort of like a slight flu, but even today in the morning, I worked on two of them. Mm-hmm. Neither one of them is anywhere close to being done, but they got better. And sometimes it's super clear, like I make a move, And it's like it clicks, and I'm like, okay, this is it. And it, I have to admit, it clicks for me. Like, we just had an exhibition. I'm coming from Austria, and we had an exhibition high up in the mountains, over 3,000 meters. And three of the paintings sold, none of them I would have picked. These were not my three favorite pieces at all. So it's interesting that I had three favorites, but very clearly different people have different points of views on that. But I, like, for me, it's very clear. But then for me, it's also very clear if I go to a museum or a gallery, I'm super judgmental. Like, I go, shit, oh, this is good.
You know, the reason I asked that, I still feel real magic with art school ethos, just that being surrounded by the work and the physical and then the digital and the data and the research, that entire ecosystem, that process, I think is when creativity really comes alive. I think that we can box ourselves into much, like a lot of students today will start and end on a screen before they've even had the chance to try anything organic or anything with their hands or a conversation with anyone. And it's all of the sum of those things that feeds truly great creativity. And I heard a term recently, Athena Akapis, who is a professor in Arizona. She has this amazing project researching apocalypse psychology. So the way humans behave in times of crisis. And she talks about evolutionary mismatch in a lot of the lifestyles today. So much time on screen, not much physical activity, not enough community. So that's why I ask, because when I see a project like this and I see shots from your studio, and it just fills me with magic, and I imagine what that's like. And you just mentioned some really interesting people there with that process and the resin and the woodwork. And it's just, to me, that is pure and it's beautiful.
I mean, there's also, you know, science will very much support this opinion.
Yep.
You know, if you look at happiness divided by jobs, woodworkers are way up on top. And of course, it's because they see what they've done all day, you know, specifically if you made a chair or a cabinet, and you have ownership, and it's meaningful to you that you made that. You know, while if you work at a giant insurance agency, and you're this tiny cog where you don't really, where you can't really feel what you actually contributed to that machinery, it's much, much, much more difficult.
Yeah. And that's where the downtime, the sabbaticals, and a sabbatical could be 2 minutes to somebody. You know, it could be when I was a new parent, my sabbaticals were on the toilet. You know, that's when I did my writing. I would, you know, literally hide in the bathroom for 5 minutes just to get a bit of my emotional creativity out, because I wanted to be a great dad, but I couldn't quite go to that space until I just created something. One line of prose was enough. You know, and now, so it can be 2 minutes today, it can be a year.
I heard the story of a new father who, when he finally packed his two girls into the back seats of the minivan going on holiday, he would go the back way around to his driver's seat, and not the front way, because the back way is longer, and that would be his holiday.
That's tremendous. So, you know, I think there's immense power in personal. And I think that we don't feel just how powerful that can be. One example in this book that blew me away was the John Grant example, the haberdasher who... Could you tell us about that? Because I think that's got great resonance, and it shows just how...
Sorry, you have to help me.
So you talk about John Grant, who is... was a British haberdasher who in his own time had interest in mortality rates. And
That's actually Steven Pinker talks about that.
Is that Steven Pinker?
That's Steven Pinker. Yeah, so basically I was lucky enough to talk one of my heroes, a scientist, Steven Pinker, into writing the foreword for the book. And he really figured this out, but you tell the story. It's Richard Stevens.
Well, essentially, this guy, John Grant, he, through his own interest in mortality rates and the cause of death, he started to research the records, the very base. I don't think there were records. This is the point. He was a haberdasher, so this was just his personal line of inquiry in his own time. But he accidentally invented epidemiology, which today, you know, is still with us.
Yes.
I think if that doesn't amplify the power of personal and those little passion projects, no matter how niche or weird or whatever they are, I think that we can't underestimate just how important they can be and the messages that we spread. Is that something you'd agree with?
But I think it goes, I think that that's one direction where the personal is super important. I think that for us, considering we're in communications, I think all of us noticed that a personal story is just so much stronger and so much more interesting than a wide story. Meaning, I definitely noticed it when I did the research for happiness and for beauty, where I read so many scientific works, and I noticed that my interest grew exponentially as soon as the scientist talked about her own life, as opposed to a wide story of some research that she commissioned. Even though the research would, of course, be much more factual than her anecdote. But from an interesting point of view, it was vice versa. And so I feel, meaning I think that that's been a tradition of our studio ever pretty much from the beginning, to basically put the human-made personal into forefront, be that with clearly hand-created typography, or probably more importantly, be that through content where either we would bring ourselves into it, or we would make it very clear from a visual perspective that this was made by humans, or that this really was not objective, that this was a subjective, opinionated piece, which I normally find much more interesting than this, you know, I'm of an age where I started in the 80s and 90s when Swiss and American modernism ruled graphic design. And to me, this was always idiotic. Like, this idea that you should make everything look like it's been made by a machine to communicate content was like, it would be like a company saying, oh, we don't want humans to answer our telephones. Let's have it all made by answering machines, like the visual equivalent from that. So we always worked against that. Now, it's almost a little bit the opposite because of the clearly human-made antique paintings, we actually are definitely trying to be very slick with the inserts, simply as a contrast to the painting. In the first round of paintings that we made, 3 or 4 years ago, we actually did oil-painted canvases as inserts into the oil-painted paintings. And they were a bit too similar to me. Like they had, you know, something of when you're wearing a red-brown sweater with a green-brown trousers, it doesn't quite match. And I think now we are really because the surfaces, not just the colors and the haptic is different, but also the glossiness and the way it's made is so different that you really have these two very different things clashing on top of each other, which I think is more pleasing to most of us, definitely to me.
I'd agree. And I think it's absolutely crucial to, in particular reference to confronting big problems that are scary and they freak us out, to not fall victim to that. I think fun, and enjoyment, and again that interest in the creative pull on a personal level is really important. And I think this is a masterful example of activism. I think this is activism, and I think it's done in a way that could be a lesson to anyone who feels that they don't have a voice against the problems that we face. Because I personally felt like, oh my God, I can't be everything to everyone, but the world is in a mess, and I want to. And that's not the case. I think that's why I mentioned the personal, because it can be small, it can be whimsical. That has to be determined by us and our feelings and our personal passions. And when you really feel that and really go towards that, I think that doors open. However you want to describe that. One friend of mine describes it as invisible hands.
Mm-hmm.
The feeling that when you're on the right course and you are committed to that and moving forward, that you see the opportunities in front of you and things come into your path. Is that something you experience in this more meaningful work that you've been creating?
I mean, I think a pivotal moment for me in my designy life was, for one thing, working for Tibor Kalman, who was a big mentor for me. And he always talked this design as a language. And I didn't get it right in the beginning, but I thought about it during the first sabbatical. And then it seemed to me that I had really learned this language. I went to school twice. I did a master degree in Brooklyn after doing a bachelor in Vienna. And I thought, so, okay, if this is really true that design is a language, why am I only using it for commercial purposes? Like, it would be completely idiotic for me to, let's say, learn Spanish and then only talk in commercial sentences in Spanish and not say anything personal. And once that insight sank in, I thought, well, let's see if I have something to say in this language that I've learned in graphic design. And it turned out that it is a very strong language that can express things differently than literature can, or than pure visuals can. It's its own thing, mm-hmm. and it can do that quite well. And ultimately, I think if I think about the most basic definition of good design that I've ever came across, it would be design that helps somebody and design that delights somebody. And if it can do both, it absolutely 100% is good design.
Yeah.
And ultimately, if you analyze this, it's basically the helping part is the functionality, which most pieces of design need to have to even qualify as design. And the other piece is the joy, the aesthetics, the beauty, the, if you want, the artistic side of it. And it really does need both. And there was a time, maybe from 1950 to 1990, when many designers and many architects thought, oh, it's only about functionality. If we make it functional, it will become beautiful by its own, out of a complete misunderstanding of form follows function. And it was catastrophic. They built, you know, public housing projects under the term of functionalism that nobody wanted to live in, that had high crime rates, that ultimately were not fit for human habitation, that did not function. Functionalism actually did not function. And by now, many architects, definitely the good ones, if you listen to Jacques Herzog from Herzog and Demiron, or a good number of others, high-end architects, have ultimately realized that we need beauty as part of this whole thing to increase functionality, because in many ways, beauty is a function. You know, I don't have it with me, but it's over there. I have a bag that I think is beautiful. It's now 35 years old. So the sustainability of that bag is way higher than any of those silly cotton tote bags, because I've been using the same bags for 35 years. So its functionality, as in sustainability, has been unbelievably heightened by its beauty. Mm. If it wouldn't have been beauty, I would have thrown it out after 2 years and bought a new one.
Yeah.
And in many ways in that direction. So, meaning ultimately, and we looked at our own work through that filter.
Yeah.
Do we believe that this helped somebody? Do we believe that it delighted somebody? And much of it didn't.
Yeah. And I think that, you term it as a language, which is wonderful. And I think that it's who you speak that language to and with is pivotal to harness the power of that. And I have a friend, Bud Moore, who runs a company called Scenic. And he works specifically to design for companies in sectors that are doing amazing work environmentally. So he works with people who are cultivating plastic-eating fungi and bioplastics. Mm-hmm. And the real breakthroughs that we're going to need. But he recognizes that there's a lack of unity for those companies to get the right funding, to collaborate with the right people, so that we can accelerate the growth of these crucial fields. Mm-hmm. That's power, you know? And that was Bud's personal line of inquiry. It doesn't have to be that profound, but it goes to show that actually design is everywhere, and it really depends who you do that with and why. But that why has to come from within. So I would encourage everyone to think about your own why and don't put too much weight on that. Be led by your own passions and little idiosyncrasies and anything at all, and don't question that. Follow that line. Is that something you'd agree with, Stefan?
I also think that this collaboration between those companies is going to improve incredibly after the pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think it was this watershed moment where many of us non-scientists and scientists really for the first time worked on the same worldwide problem.
Mm-hmm.
And many connections, definitely among scientists, were made during that time. And I think we have a much better feeling and understanding of worldwide problems,
yep,
and the necessity to basically coordinate that. So yep, I think that we will see, if we look back in 20 years on to the post-pandemic years, I think we'll see quite a lot of curves going upwards.
I think so. I think there's a sea change in psychology since, you know, something that drove us apart in many ways has brought a lot of things home to roost that are actually bringing us together, and I think we're starting to see that, which is very positive, you know. It's quite a big question, but I came across a term recently, and it was intergenerational equity, and it's the idea that we place as much value on future generations as we do right now here in our lifetimes. I think I've always felt that way to a degree. Is that something that you considered? You think about where this work sits in 100 years, in 200 years?
Well, I'm not a good predictor of the future. I've definitely been wrong in the past. And like any designer here but off, I've already answered the question quite a lot, where do I think AI will bring us? But in general, I think if I look at the past, which I did extensively over the past 5 years, and I see that almost everything that is important to us, as in we'd rather be fat than be hungry, we'd rather be alive than dead, we'd rather be at peace than in war, we'd rather live in a democracy than in a dictatorship, or we'd rather be healthy than sick. All of those things have been measured by we have very good data on that from the UN, from the World Bank, and all of that stuff has improved. And even if I look at my own past, if I compare what I was worried about in my 20s, one of the worries that I had was overpopulation. It turned out that we as humanity were much more flexible than I gave us credit for when I was in my 20s. Almost nobody thinks that overpopulation is a problem. It's in fact goes into the opposite direction, where many, specifically wealthy countries, have the opposite problem. You see it in Germany, you see it in Japan, but it's coming in many, many other places. And so I believe that there is no reason for me to see that we won't be able to display this sort of flexibility for the problems, for the massive problems that needs to be solved. And I, for sure it's true, and I understand that some of these problems, specifically global warming, the climate catastrophe, the death of many species, we just didn't have 200 years ago. So they were not around, they were not a problem, even though global warming, actually, we started the problem with the Industrial Revolution 200 years ago, and all the shits that we put up there 200 years ago is still up there, and we still have to solve it now. But having said that, if I look at developments, for example, of technology, it just turned out that with every technology that we invented, more of us used it for good than for bad. More people used the hammer to build a house than to kill their neighbor. And I feel that we are going to that same mindset that we've displayed over the past 2,000 years will continue to go on.
Yep.
Yes, we'll do a lot of shit with AI, but ultimately we will have to take care of the side effects, the ones that we know now, and the ones that will emerge in the next couple of years that we have no clue yet about, for then to progress go on again. So I myself, and I was asked recently, if you would have a time machine, what era would you choose? And I for sure would go into the future.
Yeah.
You know, I'm 61 years old now, so I sadly won't be around in 2080, but I certainly would love to.
Mm-hmm.
Because I believe it's going to be meaning I already think we live in fantastically interesting times, but I think that 50, 70 years from now is going to be mind-boggling.
I agree. Well, I mean, you've changed my life with this body of work, so thank you on a personal level. I also
it's a nice thing for you to say, thank you.
I also have friends in war who you've helped them. I think it's going to continue to be the case. I hope that everybody in here will look at Stefan's book, because it's incredible and it's a tonic to our time. So thank you very much, and thank you for taking the time to do this.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for listening. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much to Stefan Sagmeister for taking the time to come to Barcelona and have a real magical conversation for me, a real career highlight. I will look back on this fondly for forevermore. And it's interesting, because as I watched the video back when Off sent out the speaker videos, it was very surreal, because what happens is you go on stage and there's so much to consider. You know, where are your notes going to be placed? Where is the drink? When do I open the drink? Will I knock the drink over? Do I look into Stefan's eye? Do I look at the audience sometimes? What if I run out of time? Because you can see a countdown timer clock on the stage. So, the nerves. So all of that combined and stirred together makes for a very surreal, quite quick, not forgotten, but quite quickly blurred out experience. So, you know, that was interesting to watch it back on video, because it started to fill in a few, memory blanks. And I don't know whether that's kind of artificial memory because I've now seen the video, but I don't think it was, because the memories were from where I was sitting in the chair in the video. I'm going to get the video on YouTube. So if you want to see that and watch, you know, everything, the body language and the rest of it, then you might enjoy that format. I don't often do video podcasts, but because we have the footage from off, I'm going to share that. You might have seen some clips I teased it with this week, but very surreal, very weird, and I will remember that for forevermore. Stefan was very pleased with the chat everybody at off was, and the feedback from the audience was that we did capture the same intimacy that these podcast chats tend to have, but in an arena of 2,000 plus people. So I'm absolutely delighted with that. Very keen to do more of these. So if you get the opportunity to get in touch and chat about having me do that, let me know. I'm going to be speaking at DNAD New Blood Festival in July. I'm not at liberty to talk about my guest or the angle yet, but I've got a big one, a good one lined up, so might see a few of you there. Thank you, as ever, to Illustration X, the founding sponsor of the show. Thank you to the Ukrainian Institute for connecting your wonderful Ukrainian creatives with the global community. If any of you guys want to help those guys out who are in just such turmoil in the middle of a war, then I suggest you do. Share their work, commission them, collaborate with them, do what you can. They really need it. ui.org.ua. Thank you for listening, guys. Get in touch. hello@bentallon.com or on social media. I'm on LinkedIn very prominently these days. Instagram is the fallback platform, either _ creative condition or @bentallon. Use those accounts relatively equally these days. So get in touch. Not so much on X these days. I will use it occasionally, but I'm trying to trim my social use and really, you know, double down on the platforms that I like better. So get in touch. Give us a shout. Let me know if you want to be on an episode, if you've got a good angle to share. I will do that. I need to be lining up my next list of interviewees soon. I've got some good ones coming up. So cheers for listening, guys. Thank you again to Stefan, Off Team, and all of you lot. Nice one. Have an awesome week. Oh, and you can get the Creative Condition book now at bentallonwriter.com/shop. It's there with a bundle of Champagne and Wax Crayons, my first book. You can also get it in ebook format. Very proud of this as a body of work. 10 years of research, 2.5 years of writing. Wonderful feedback so far. So there you have it. Nice one, guys. Take care. Have a great week.